Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely under House Rule 10.01. We will start with the roll. Ms. Borgerding, please go ahead with the roll.
Chair Becker Fenn.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long. Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Robbins, present. Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
And Representative Long.
Present.
All right, a quorum is present. Representative Long, do I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 9th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. We do have a really full agenda today, members, but we're going to start out with a presentation from the courts, but I'll just ask members to do their best to stay focused so that we can fit everything in and hear the bills we have on the agenda today. And with that, we are going to start with a presentation from the district courts. Members will remember Mr. Shorba from earlier this year. Mr. Shorba, please introduce yourself for the record, and then you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Shorba. I'm the State Court Administrator for the Judicial Branch, and it's nice to be back with you today. And I'm here today to present the Judicial Branch budget request for fiscal year 22 and 23. So hopefully you can see that on the screen here. So I wanted to start just with a brief overview of our budget. Our budget is allocated in three pots, one for the district court, which is obviously our largest allocation, the Court of Appeals, and then the Supreme Court allocation, which also includes funding for the State Court Administrator's Office, as well as the State Law Library. Just for your information, funding for the third branch of government here in Minnesota is a little less than 2%, about 1.5% of the total general fund budget for the state. So that's a pretty small number to fund the third branch of government, but we appreciate all the funding that we've received from the legislature. So we began looking at the 22-23 budget request almost a year ago. And I want to take just a minute to explain how we came up with this budget request. The Judicial Council, which I talked about in my overview hearing a little while ago, is the policymaking body for the branch. It's chaired by the Chief Justice. There are 25 members. And the council really considered many important and worthy proposals brought forward by our judges and staff across the state. Ultimately, we debated internally about what our priorities were, some of the things we didn't get funding for last biennium. But we really decided that we need to make our top priority our staff and judges, our people who are helping us to deal with not only the pandemic, but certainly the backlog that I talked about last time. So we're asking for, over the biennium, about $17.7 million. That's about a 2.4% increase over our base budget. And the council decided on this request for a couple of reasons. The first year, we wanted to really partner with the legislature and the governor to recognize that this is a very difficult time for our state economically. And so the first year FY22 request is really a hold harmless request to help while the state wrestles with the projected budget shortfall. So the only new funding that the branch is seeking for FY22 is money to cover the employer share of unavoidable health insurance cost increases. We do not separately negotiate health care increases. Instead, we rely on the numbers given to us by Minnesota Management and Budget, and that is reflected in the $2.8 million in fiscal year 22. In the second year of the biennium, fiscal year 23, we're seeking funding for a 3% increase in compensation for our judges and staff, in addition to those costs that you see in the first line in terms of employer share of healthcare costs. We're hopeful that the state is going to be on a better financial footing by fiscal year 23, thereby allowing for some needed investment in our people. We went through the Great Recession for 5 years, not giving any increases to our staff and judges to avoid layoffs. We understand we may need to do that for another year, but we're hoping that we don't have to do that for a biennium so we don't fall further behind like we did the last time. I do want to note that our entire request is included in the governor's proposed FY22-23 biennial budget request. This request, we believe, is modest, but also realistic. We wanted to recognize the situation the state is in, but it's also, as the Chief Justice says, hopeful that things will be better in the second year, and we can take care of that asset I talked about earlier, our people. So that's really the budget request. It's sort of short and sweet, but I wanted to lay it out. And I know I've talked, and the Chief Justice has talked to many of you already, and we'll talk to the rest of you individually. But I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the budget request, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Sorry about that. I couldn't see my mouse, so I couldn't move to the unmute button. Sorry about that. Representative Scott has a question. Go ahead, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the presentation, Mr. Shorba. I can't help but mention the huge jump year over year in the cost of health insurance. Did MMB give you any indication as to why that jump was so significant?
Mr. Shorba.
These are estimates from Minnesota Management and Budget. Sometimes they go up, sometimes they go down. They're obviously dependent primarily on negotiations with the unions in terms of what the employee share will be, and also negotiations with healthcare companies to see what best deal the state can get. I just know the numbers are around 5% each year. I can't tell you exactly how that compares with other years. Some have been higher, some have been lower, but that's the only explanation I got, that they're estimating that there's going to be some increases given the negotiation status, I assume primarily with the healthcare companies.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
No, Madam Chair, just another point was just that I believe in the last biennium, we gave increases to judges and staff of 2.5% each year, so basically, that adds up to a 5% increase. And so I believe that that's probably the only, I don't know if we've had increases prior to that post the Great Recession or not, but just wanted to let new members know that that was what happened in the last biennium. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker, Finn, members, again, this question for Mr. Shorba. I was looking at it. It's only got like a little over a 2 million, the screen has gone down, a little over 2 billion increase in healthcare costs this coming year. But it would look like it's close to about 6 million the second year of the biennium. Can you explain why such a huge jump in 1 year? That's more than a 5% increase.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, you have to add the second year cost onto the first year. So the first year goes up by 5%, and so you're already at a higher base, and then you have to add on the additional percentage to it. So that's why it increases so significantly.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerman, Mr. Shorba, I just For me, I'd like to be able to figure it out by cost per employee. About how many employees does that cover?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we have about 2,500 employees and a little over 300 judges, so almost 3,000 staff.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, I know I saw Representative Liebling's hand go up and down. Representative Liebling, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was answered.
Got it. All right, members, any further questions for Mr. Shorba? I am absolutely certain that as we dig into the numbers and move forward, that Mr. Shorba will remain available to answer questions as we have them. So please do not hesitate to reach out to him or to let the committee know if there's information that folks will find helpful as our budget discussions move forward this year. So thank you for being efficient, Mr. Shorba, and I'm sure this is not the last time we'll see you this year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Look forward to it.
All right. Thank you. And so with that, members, we'll move on to our first bill today. The first bill on our agenda is Representative Zhang Zhe bill, House File 441. It is regarding the Human Rights Act Certificate of Compliance provision. And we will welcome Representative Zhang to the committee. He is not a member of this committee this year, so I will move his bill. And we will just be laying this bill over members for possible inclusion in a judiciary omnibus bill. And so with that, I just want to make sure we have Representative Zhang in the room. We do. Representative Zhang, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm excited to be back here in the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. Good morning, members and Madam Chair. This morning, I am presenting House File 441. It is a bill helping the state of Minnesota close racial and gender disparities when it comes to state contracting. The Department of Human Rights has monitored state contracts for workforce participation goals since 1974. and paid for equal work law since 2014. However, as an enforcement agency, they've been limited with enforcement tools when it came to facing with a non-compliant state contractor. And so under current law, their main option is to suspend a contractor's workforce or equal pay certificate if they are non-compliant and non-responsive with the department. So what this bill would do is, it gives the department an intermediate enforcement tool by giving them the option to levy small fines up to $5,000 on a state contractor who is non-compliant with the state's equity and inclusion commitments. It's important to note that these are often multi-million dollar state contracts, and if a business is fulfilling its equity and inclusion commitments, then this bill would never impact them. And so today, I also have Commissioner Rebecca Lucero from the department who will share more details on the bill with you all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. We'll go ahead with Commissioner Lucero. Commissioner Lucero, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Human Rights. First, I want to thank Representative Zhang for carrying our department's compliance and state contracting bill today. Representative Zhang did a great job of explaining what the bill does, and I'm just going to expand on a few points about how we got to House File 441 and the limited situations in which we could find ourselves needing to use it. So the Minnesota Human Rights Act is the foundation of the department's work. The act, passed into law in 1967, protects the civil rights of all Minnesotans. As I shared in the committee a few weeks ago, and as Representative Zhang just stated, the legislature has long identified the importance of being intentional around ensuring that we are creating welcoming and inclusive workplaces for all Minnesotans. Now, the act does this specifically by tasking the department with regulating state contractors to ensure men and women are compensated equally for equal work and to ensure that contractors are making good faith efforts to maintain inclusive and equitable workforces so that companies' employees reflect Minnesotans' vibrant communities. The legislature said, if we're going to be spending millions of dollars in Minnesota, we're going to do it intentionally to align with these values of creating a thriving community for all Minnesotans. So how does this work in practice? So if a state agency has a project that's over $100,000 and they contract with a business with 40 or more employees, the contractor is required to obtain what's called a workforce certificate from our department. This commits the contractor to making good faith efforts to recruit, hire, and retain women and or people of color and indigenous community members working on that project. Now, if the project is over $500,000, the contractor is also required to apply for an equal pay certificate, requiring the contractor to pay men and women equal for equal work. So it's important to know that both of these certificates last for 4 full years. So when a project starts, a contractor sends our department reports that document the progress that they're making towards their good faith efforts to diversify their workplace. And we work with them where they need assistance to see what we can help. So I do want to be really clear. The vast majority of the contractors we work with are great partners. They provide us all the required information, and we work together to intentionally create welcoming and inclusive work sites. Last time we met, I in fact laid out some of the great work that occurred with the Capital Restoration Project, one of the largest construction projects in Minnesota. In that situation, contractor J.E. Dunn partnered with local nonprofits to bring more people of color and women into the industry. And I noted at the time that they were able to keep employees beyond the project so that more than 80% are still in the trades today. So this state project did more than renovate the historic building. It helped build historically disenfranchised communities into well-paying careers. So we saw that being intentional matters and it makes a difference. However, if we're faced with a rare situation of a state contractor being non-compliant, non-responsive, maybe even falsifying information, our current enforcement tool, our only enforcement tool, is a blunt object. It's complete suspension or revocation of the certificate. This blunt tool of certificate suspension is not a productive first step. It's certainly not what we want to be doing in developing these partnerships with contractors. That's why we developed House File 441, which gives our department a much more intermediate and moderate enforcement tool that we can use if needed. So in practice, if there's a contractor who is not in compliance, who's falsifying information, they are continuing to ignore our department after numerous attempts, with this bill, we can then levy a small fine, no more than $5,000, to help compel the contractor into compliance. And we can ensure the project keeps moving forward without interruptions. These are huge multi-million dollar projects. And so we just need to get everyone into compliance and do the work together. So we're bringing this forward today in order to combat Minnesota's racial and gender disparities. The department needs to have the enforcement tools necessary to help bring contractors into compliance with equity hiring goals and equal pay protections on state contracts. I really want to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I stand for any questions. Projects.
Right. Members, do we have any questions about House File 441? All right. I guess you guys did a really good job of presenting the bill and explaining what it does. Seems like a good idea. Okay, members. Well, we are just going to be laying this bill over for possible inclusion. There were not any amendments filed to this bill at this point, so we will lay it over and want to thank Representative Zhang and Commissioner Lucero for presenting the bill this morning. And we've got one hand up here. Representative Grossel.
My apologies, Madam Chair. I had to find my way back to this screen before when you asked if we had any questions. I guess one question primarily for Ms. Lucero or the author, if they would be willing. Do we have any of these businesses that are that they're having issues with, or is this, I think I heard somewhere in there that it was few and far between.
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and Representative Grossel, for your question. Yeah, it is a tool that we would use rarely. So let me give you an example. In the past, we were working on a project where we were about 80% into the project when we discovered that a contractor was actually falsifying the data and information they were sending to us. Our only enforcement tool at that point was to suspend the contract, but it wasn't appropriate. It would have had a greater consequences to the state, costing substantial amounts of money, delaying the project, delaying people being able to work, which wasn't what we wanted to do. We wanted to bring them into compliance. And that's an example of where House File 441 is important, and why we would want to be able to use this tool.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. I mean, I guess you cited this one example. I mean, are you having issues with this, or is this, like you said, a rare thing where you're finding somebody that's not filling out the paperwork, not being honest on their paperwork?
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Grossel, yes, we do have issues on this. It's limited, and having the blunt tool makes it really hard to have the conversation. That's why we need to have this tool when necessary.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grossel.
I guess, and then I look at the fine, $5,000. Where did, how did we come up with that number? Because I see another, one of their fines was only $100 or something like that.
Commissioner.
Yeah, Chair Beckerfin, Representative Grossel, thank you for that question. You know, we have seen in our department how a small fine can sometimes be all that's needed to help bring businesses into compliance. These are massive contracts. And so the $5,000 represents a small fine, up to $5,000, that can be used to help bring a business into compliance. It's actually, these small fines are used by many enforcement agencies to help with enforcement without having to use more blunt and aggressive tools.
Representative Grossel, final follow-up.
You know, I guess just that if this is something that, if that other, was the other incident, was that corrected with the warning?
Commissioner.
That situation was not corrected. We did not have a good tool. We worked with them, but it was not where we needed it to be.
So it was the permit suspended then?
Representative Grossel.
Oh, sorry, Madam Chair. Was the permit suspended then?
Commissioner Lucero.
Sorry, Chair Beckerfin. Representative Grossel, online is always a challenge. Let's see. I am not sure if that specific one ultimately ended up, it did not get suspended for that project. No, it did not get suspended for that project.
Okay. I don't know. All right. Well, I guess that's as far as I need to go, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yep. Moving on to Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Lucero and Representative John, thank you for bringing this bill. I think what we see here and what Commissioner Lucero just explained is that we have a situation where, because we only have this blunt object, in a particular situation you described, we couldn't take action, which means we can't deter future contractors from doing the same issue. If they understand that, especially with these big contracts, the cost that it will have to the state to actually just suspend that contract and remove those contractors, they'll continue to do this. So I think this is a good bill. It gives them a tool to work around that and to create the deterrence that we need, so folks are not going to be dishonest on reporting these numbers, these contracts. And also, it's going to achieve the goal that we have with meeting our compliance and diversity goals for our state and our residents. So thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And I know the ability to leverage fines is something that many other agencies have to make sure folks are compliant. Next on the list is Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative John, for the bill and Commissioner. So I just want to follow on to Representative Grossel's question. Is there a scale for the $5,000 violation, or how? How do we decide if that's $100, $2,500, or $5,000? Have we considered that? Do we have a plan there?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Farr. Yeah, I think it would really depend on the situation. I think it's really important to note that our department works to exhaust every option before we need to use any enforcement tool. We offer lots of opportunities to connect, trainings, et cetera. So we can use it as an escalating tactic as needed after we've exhausted every other attempt to get in touch with them and work with them.
Follow-up, Representative Farr.
Yes, just one follow-up. So is this a one fine per violation, or if they don't correct the violation with a $100 fine, then do we move to the $1,000 fine, or help me understand that, please?
Commissioner.
Representative Farr, yes, it would be up to $5,000 per violation.
All right, and Representative Johnson, we don't normally go to multiple questions per person, but we've got a little bit of time, so Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, just a quick follow-up to some of the other questions that were going on. Instead of a fine, I'm just wondering if a particular contractor continually has issues on different projects, if they get on a list not to be able to obtain a state contract.
Commissioner.
Chair Representative Johnson, thank you for that question. You know, that is basically what suspending a certificate does. If a contractor has their certificate suspended, it means they cannot work on most state-funded projects or bid for projects. That's ultimately not in the interest of what we are trying to do here. We really want contractors to be able to bid. We want them to be working towards these goals. We want to do so in partnership with them. And that's why we would like for us to be able to have tools to create compliance instead of the blunt tool of simply suspending their license and banning them from being able to bid on state-funded projects. That's not where we're trying to go.
Any follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Chair Becker Finn, Commissioner Lucero. Sir. I understand that, but if these companies knew that they would no longer be able to work on these contracts, I think they would be much better at staying in compliance. Even if they get fines regularly, their certificates can be suspended. But I think I don't want those companies to be working for if they're not in compliance. But I also want to make sure that they have the best employees possible to keep the costs down and to have the best, especially on a bridge. I don't want somebody that's not qualified working on a bridge, building a bridge. I want to make sure we have the best qualified employees as well.
All right. Final question to Representative Mortensen.
Thanks. Well, that kind of dovetails perfectly to my question. My question for the commissioner is, if I'm a contractor, and I hire based on the best people for the job, and I give no consideration to what people look like, what gender they might be. I just want the best people that are going to perform for my company. Do I run the risk of being non-compliant to what we're talking about?
Commissioner Lucero.
I'm Chair Becker Finn, Representative Mortensen. No, you need to be working towards your workforce goals, which means, you know, being really intentional about where you're recruiting from and bringing in as many qualified applicants of all races as possible. Like an example of where you would get in trouble, however, is if you were paying men and women differently for the same job. That's a place where we would say, look, you're not in compliance with your equal pay certificate. And if you refuse after numerous attempts to get into compliance, that's where we would have some problems.
Representative Mortensen.
I waited for you there. Thanks, Chair. So I felt like that was two answers. So if my workforce goals, as I wrote that down, my workforce goals would be hiring the best people for the job. But Commissioner, your answer said that my workforce goal should be trying to find people of certain skin colors. And I think any company is trying to do the right thing. I don't know how many companies are actually out there trying to hire in a discriminatory way, but I think most companies' goals is just give me the best people so I can do this job as best as possible. So it does seem like the answer to my question would actually be yes, a company is at risk of being in violation if their goal is just simply hiring the best people and then not caring whatever they might look like or what their gender might be.
All right. We've got a couple more minutes. So in a couple more hands went up. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that I'm not hearing this. And I hope that I'm not hearing that when we talk about creating access for communities that have been excluded from these jobs in the past, that we're saying that lower standards. I just want to make sure that I'm not hearing that. And I hope we're careful about not implying that in this venue.
Thank you. Representative Robbins, and then we will lay this bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I just wanted to follow up quickly on something you said in an earlier reply. You mentioned that they would be not in compliance if they were paying men and women differently. And I just wondered if you could expound on that a little bit. I get paying people the same for the same job if they also have the same level of experience. But if you have someone who's brand new to the job versus someone who's been on the job 20 years, is there any allowance for productivity or experience in the differences in the pay between genders? Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Robbins, thank you for the question. So if a project is over $500,000, the contractor is required to apply for the equal pay certificate, which does require the contractor to pay men and women equal pay for equal work. I'd be happy to meet with you offline to talk about how we do that analysis and what that looks like.
Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Robbins.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Lucero. I would like to do that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, members. We will lay over House File 441 for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Omnibus Bill. Sure. So thank you. Oh, Representative Zhang, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just wanted to address this notion that somehow falling through with this bill means that the requirement to hire people of certain skin color over qualified people, this notion that somehow people from certain background is not as equally qualified is just plain wrong. And that's why we have to have this bill in place to ensure that we are addressing the racial disparities in our state. And so it is my hope that we do include this as well, we move forward with representation. So thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Commissioner Lucero and I look forward to continuing this conversation with many of you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for refocusing us, Representative Zhang. And House File 441 is laid over for possible inclusion. With that, members, we will move on to the next bill on our agenda, which is House File 9. Democracy for the People Act. I will remind members that this bill has already had a lengthy hearing in the State Government Finance and Elections Committee in actually almost two full days of committee, and still has a number of additional stops. And so we will try as best we can to focus on the provisions in the bill that relate to what our committee has jurisdiction over. And in particular for this bill, there are some data provisions. So I know that Ms. Ghanani listed those provisions in the posting. But if members have questions, we'll try to stick to that as much as we can. And with that, I will welcome Representative Greenman to our committee. Since Representative Greenman isn't on the committee, I will move that House File 9 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Greenman, welcome to the committee, and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I'm glad to be here with you this morning. I'm grateful to present the House File 9. This bill defends, strengthens, and modernizes Minnesota's best traditions of voter participation, sound election administration, transparency in government, and grassroots campaigns. This common sense package of solutions rests on the premise that our state works best when the voices of Minnesotans are at the center of our democracy. When all Minnesotans, Black, Brown, Indigenous, White, Greater Minnesota and Metro Minnesota, rich, poor, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and folks with no party at all, when Minnesotans power our democracy. I'm going to turn it over in a second to House Research to help walk us through the provisions that this committee is hearing. But I just want to start with a little bit of background about why this bill is important. The last year saw our democracy tested in really unimaginable ways. We conducted a presidential election during a pandemic that required a heroic effort by elections officials and Minnesota voters to ensure we had safe, secure, and well-run election. 30,000 Minnesotans, local elections officials and election judges, our friends and neighbors from every corner of the state showed up. They put their health on the line to help us conduct a safe and secure election. And like in many areas of policy, the pandemic exposed some of the cracks, the inefficiencies, and the disparities in our voting system. And last year, we also saw our democracy tested by a rising climate of disinformation, rhetoric, and fear of intimidation. Here in Minnesota, we saw an out-of-state security firm, Atlas Aegis, reportedly recruiting armed security contractors to come to Minnesota to be at polling places. Well, the good work of the Attorney General's office was able to prevent that, that this time, the threats and intimidation of voters and elections officials has been on the rise across the country. And just a month ago, we all witnessed the dangerous and tragic consequences of that rise targeting our elections. The last election also highlighted problems Minnesotans have been asking the legislature to tackle for years. The 50,000 Minnesotans living in our community disenfranchised because of a felony conviction. The ever more money in our elections dominated by big donors and outside spending. And the need to ensure Minnesota voters, not corporations, not national forces, but Minnesotans are at the center of our democracy. This bill responds to that urgent and overdue need with reforms that make our systems more accessible to voters. It defends the right to vote, including strong provisions to protect voters, elections officials, and election volunteers from intimidation and harassment by giving law enforcement the tools they need to fight deceptive practices and acts of disinformation intended to interfere with the vote. It strengthens the right to vote by modernizing voter registration, by improving the way voters cast their ballots, by restoring the right to vote for returning citizens, and by ensuring that every voter has the information they need in the language they need it to be able to confidently vote. And it modernizes our campaign finance system to increase the influence of voters and small donors in our districts and across the state. It puts Minnesota at the center of our democracy. Minnesotans. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Nathan Hopkins to walk through the relevant provisions of House File 9.
Right. Mr. Hopkins, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, Nathan Hopkins, nonpartisan legislative analyst with House Research. I'm going to go through the bill quickly and just highlight for members the portions of the bill that are relevant to this committee's jurisdiction today. Article 1, Section 1 of the bill, this is on page 2. This creates a cross-reference in Chapter 13 to a private data classification in the bill. That private data classification is on page 14 of the bill, at lines 12 through 13. That states that data on applicants, voter registration applicants that are determined to be not eligible to vote are private data on individuals. The next section is Article 1, Section 11. That is on page 10 of the bill. This has to do with the pre-registration for 16-year-olds or older. It states that data on applicants submitted pursuant to that section, the pre-registration, are not part of public information lists until the voter is registered or has voting history. Article 2, Section 1 is on page 15 of the bill. This deals with the restoration of the right to vote for people after who receive a felony conviction after their period of incarceration has ended. Article 2, Section 16 is on page 25 of the bill. This deals with absentee voting instructions being provided in languages other than English. Section 17 of Article 2 is on page 26. This states that the names of voters who have applied for an absentee ballot are public. Section 35 of Article 2 is on page 36 of the bill. And this, again, deals with notice regarding the restoration of the right to vote for people who receive a felony conviction after their period of incarceration has ended. And then Section 36 is there on page 37. It's, again, about the restoration. In Article 3 of the bill, Section 2 is on page 38. This deals with voter interference and intimidation. On page 39, it provides for Attorney General enforcement of this provision, and it also allows a private right of action by a person injured. Section 3. Article 4, Section 5 of the bill is on page 42. This deals with civil enforcement, civil penalties that can be given out by the Campaign Finance Board. On page 42, lines 8 through 10, there's a civil penalty authorized. And on page 55 of the bill, this is section 26 of Article 4. This allows the board to perform audits and investigations and assess various penalties for violations of this new several new sections of the bill. So that's everything, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. That was really helpful, and I appreciate the reference to the page numbers as well. Before we move forward to further discussion, there is an amendment to the bill. It is an amendment from Representative Vang is bringing this amendment. It is the A6. Representative Vang, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, and do you want me to say a few words before you move the amendment? Okay. So this Amendment A6, I work with Representative Freeman on crafting this language. The A6 amendment basically incorporates language access to the polls. You know, as we all know, our democracy is dependent on the right to vote. And thus, voter accessibility is key, and it's a must. So the right to vote shouldn't be dependent on how well we know English. This amendment does, you know, two things. The absentee voting instructions are in languages other than English, such as Somali, Hmong, Spanish. And that it also adds that 10 community members, registered voters, can request for interpreter at a polling place if needed. And so I would like to make the motion to move the A6 amendment.
All right. Thank you, Representative Vang. Representative Scott, is this to the A6 amendment to the or to the overall bill?
It's to the A6, Madam Chair.
Okay. Go ahead then, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so at the beginning of the introduction of this bill, we talked about this committee just focusing on the areas of the bill that pertain to this committee. And this amendment is outside of those parameters. This is really a state gov related amendment. And my question is, to me, this amendment should be offered in the state gov committee or an applicable committee. It doesn't belong here. And our House rules say that the committees should follow the rules of the House. And it says in our rules 6.21, an amendment offered in committee must be a subject that is within the jurisdiction of the committee. Now, obviously, the final call is yours, Madam Chair, on this. But where do we know where's this bill going following this committee? Did you say public safety?
And I will note that in the walkthrough that Mr. Hopkins just gave, he did cover the language provisions. And, you know, it's My understanding that the reason that that was brought in was because of our jurisdiction over human rights and civil rights. And so I, you know, that was a provision related to language access that was noticed as something that's within our jurisdiction in this committee. And yes, it's moving to public safety and criminal justice reform after this.
And Madam Chair?
Yep, Representative Scott.
Yep, thank you. So will this be bill be returning to state gov finance, who really has the purview over this? It's a pretty big change. It's a substantial change. And if it's already been to state gov finance, if you add this amendment, which I'm guessing will go on, it should eventually go back to state gov finance. And so I don't know if that's a question for the bill's author, what the plans are, or if she knows, Madam Chair.
Representative Greenman, and I will note we only have control over where it goes after this committee, but Representative Greenman, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've actually discussed this with Chair Nelson. I am not sure if it'll go back to state gov, but we did discuss putting this amendment on when Representative Vang mentioned it to me because of the language provision is already in here. And this is just expanding that to Election Day.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we're ready to pass the bill as amended, which I'm sure that's where this is going, if just you want to watch for my hand, I'll probably have a motion to send it to state gov finance. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay, thanks for the heads up. Representative Johnson, is this to the A6 amendment?
Yes, this is to the A6 amendment.
Okay, then go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Representative Riemann, maybe you can tell me. And I agree it needs to go back to state gov finance, because there's a very healthy in some of our counties and townships and even cities, a very healthy cost to this provision. When you start talking about election judges having to have be able to be interpreters for different languages, and you only have four listed, we have like 20 some different languages spoken in Minnesota. And we have townships that I know are going to go over that limit. Now these townships, not only at the state general election, at their township elections, are going to have to provide interpreters and pay them. And I know in the judiciary side of things, in the public safety side of things, we only can use interpreters that are certified, and they are very expensive. You start having one interpreter, and now you're going to need two, one for each side, both of them. Actually, if we end up with three major parties, you're going to need three of them at each polling place all day long. And with early voting, there's going to have to be three of them at every place there's a polling station the entire time that poll is open in those precincts. So this is going to have to go back to state government finance, because that is a huge cost that you could put on a county, a city, or even a township, that there's no way they can cover those costs.
I will note, it may surprise members, but I know that at least even in the one school district that my children attend, that there are actually over 100 languages spoken at home by Minnesotans in our state. So Representative Greenman, response to Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. And I appreciate, I've been talking a lot with the counties and the cities, and the issue of ensuring that our counties and cities have what they need to implement this bill did come up. Representative New Brindley asked some really good questions, and so we actually have talked about this. As it relates to this amendment, one of the things that Representative Vang and I did was talk to the Secretary of State about how we could make sure that we're providing the language access materials, which are less costly to provide, and then make sure that we're tailoring the places where we actually need an in-person election judge. And so there's mechanisms in there that do that. So I appreciate the question.
All right. Any other questions on? Oh, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Greenman. You may have talked to the counties and the 87 counties and I believe it's around 600 cities, but you have close to 4,000 townships that you haven't talked with yet.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Greenman, or Representative Greenman.
I should have, thank you, Madam Chair. I should have also said I've been talking to the lobbyists for the townships as well.
All right, thank you. With that, members, we will move. I will Representative Vang's motion to move the A6 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
All right, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And with that, Representative Greenman, do you want to give any further introduction, or should we go straight to your testifiers now?
I think we can go ahead to the testifiers. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Greenman. We do have a couple people who signed up to testify. First on my list is Mr. Oliker Friedland. If you are here, please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Sam Oliker Friedland. I'm the chief counsel for the Center for Secure and Modern Elections, which is a national organization that works nationwide on reforms that make elections more secure, more efficient, and work better for voters, administrators, and government officials. My understanding is that I'm here to sort of answer questions as appropriate. I defer to Representative Greenman if it would be appropriate for me to provide some sort of opening remarks on especially the automatic voter registration portions of the bill, but I don't want to speak too much about matters that are not before this particular committee. So I would put it back to you, Madam Chair, to sort of, if possible, ask Representative Greenman how she would like to handle my presence.
Right. Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we have, in addition to Sam, we have some folks from the Secretary of State's office and the Attorney General's office here just to answer questions. But I think in the interest of time, we wanted to focus on the public. We have some public members who I think wanna talk about how this bill would impact them.
Right, thank you. On the list next, I have Stephanie Stossel. If you could introduce yourself for the committee and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Stossel, and I am a leader in ISAIAH. In 2017, I was committed to voter turnout and reached out to people in my parish. I connected with a 67-year-old man who was convinced that he could not vote due to a prior felony charge long ago. He was no longer on paper, so I confirmed his right to vote with Ramsey County Elections and brought him his registration form. We drove together for the primary election, and I actually saw him grow 6 inches while he was voting. It was the first time at the age of 67 that this man exercised his voice in our democracy after believing all this time that he could not vote. I am also an election judge, and I had second thoughts this past election, but I chose to do so because I am healthy and I am committed to helping people vote. Yet I found myself really frustrated that some people were trying to make voting more difficult, not more accessible. The narrative to undermine vote by mail's credibility was very harmful. I am not typically a worrier, but me and my fellow judges were anxious about our health and our safety in this past election, and even the risk of violence at the polls. We have elected officials right here in Minnesota making false claims of voter fraud, undermining our election systems, and making it more difficult for people to vote. We need to believe our elections are safe, reliable, accessible, and welcoming in order to fully participate. The elements of this bill, House File 9, to expand access to our elections and protect voters is absolutely essential to move toward a fully inclusive democracy. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Stossel. Next, I have Jessica Velasco. Ms. Velasco, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jessica. I am part of the Navigate Unidos Minnesota team. I'm specifically based out of Southwest Minnesota in Worthington. This House file would support so many of our community members, not just here in Southwest Minnesota, but throughout Greater Minnesota. This year, I specifically remember supporting a first-time voter. She was a new citizen. And what had happened was she went to the voting poll that her neighbor told her to go to. She got sent to a different voting poll because they had put it into her Google Maps. Then she got sent back to the first voting poll. By that time, she called me and she said, Jessica, I'm just not going to vote. I'll wait till the next election. I rushed over debating on whether or not to go because of the pandemic. We ended up taking her to the correct voting poll. There, the women allowed me to go and support her because she was just so flustered. When you're a first-time voter, it's so intimidating. I remember taking my 18-year-old son. Now add the knowledge of the understanding that English is not your first language and you don't have the access to tools or support. I've gone to other voting poll sites and actually have been turned away because they were not allowed. I was not allowed to be there to help support them to fill out their ballot. So once you are there, it's one thing to get your ballot. It's another thing to understand the casting and filling out your entire ballot because each and every person makes a decision for your community is another thing. So I will continue to do my work and get folks to the voting poll, get them registered. I need your support in supporting them to understand how they can fill out their ballot and how they do not feel undermined or intimidated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Velasco, for your testimony. I have one other person on the list from Saro Abdullahi. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sahra Abdullahi, and I am a parent of five kids. I live in Barnesville, Egan Savage area. I work for the school district as a cultural liaison, and I have been helping community come out and vote for the past couple of years. The last 3 years, I became a member of the Muslim Coalition that's part of the ASIAC and who was in trying to get the vote out and encourage the community. So we provide transportation as a volunteers. We reach out to people, whether they are like Somalian or at the background or just friends that we met at the YMCA. And then we mobilize and pick up elderly and community members from the mosque and take them to the voting place. And sometimes if we're allowed to help them and explain, you know, what the process is and how to do it. So I have heard from many community members that express anxiety, that express that they feel intimidated, and it's a huge step, especially when you're faring for the first time, like Flasco said. And they go in there and they kind of feel like out of place and afraid. And then if it's not welcoming and, you know, like you don't see a familiar face or somebody that can help you, that you feel like out of place. Some people may even turn around and just leave and not cast their vote. So when we spoke with few people, they said, okay, we want that. We didn't understand. We didn't understand the process. And one of the ladies that I talked to said, she's not a shy person, and she's not afraid to talk in a regular setting, but she wondered, she said that I felt out of place. I was sweating. My heart was beating fast, and I was nervous, and I like was freezing, like not knowing what to do. So the lack of language resource have people feeling like no one cares about them, and it de-incentivizes and makes them feel like, you know, my foot doesn't matter. And it's hard to convince people, you know, like your voice matters. And then our job becomes like talking to people over and over again, saying your voice matters and you need to go out there and you need to vote. You're American. It doesn't matter if you lack language knowledge, but you're still American and your voice matters. And sometimes when we go there and we help people, you can see them being happy and feeling like bright and that they had some say in the decisions that impact their life, everyday life. So as a community members and our volunteers, we can't be everywhere and we can help like everybody that is supposed to vote. So having these resources, language resources available to voters, will help them feel confident and welcome, and they will feel proud to be part of the American, you know, society, because you're American whether you speak different language or not. And the daily policies that is made, it affects your life, whether it is a housing, you know, policing, like it affects our life, our daily life. So I keep like talking to people. Nobody pays me, but like I kind of feel like And I can vote, but I want everybody to have that right to vote and go out there and feel comfortable doing it. So having an interpreter and find out your area, like every area has a good module. Where I live at, there's more Spanish and Somali community. So providing those two interpreters will help a lot. And interpreters have to be non-biased. They will not be affiliated with anybody. So you can have one Somali, one Spanish, which is going to be cost effective. And that was not part of my speech, but I was listening. So I just had to throw it in there.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you to all of the testifiers for joining us this morning. With that, members, we do have, I know there are a couple other people who are here to answer questions if members have them. And so with that, we will move to discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Scott.
Sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking through the handouts posted online for the hearing of this bill, and I know this is going to be backwards when I hold it up, so this is just one of the complications of meeting online, but this document was posted, and I'm just wondering where this document came from, if you might know, Madam Chair.
I do not. Representative Greenman?
I'm not sure the document you posted. It may be the handout that was given when we release the whole bill to the press and the and to the public.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the first non-boldened headline says House DFLers are fighting to defend and strengthen our democracy. Madam Chair, this in my 12 years of being in the legislature going on 13, I've never seen a totally political document posted online for committee hearing. To me, this looks like, and it sounds like from the bill's author, that this was a totally created by the DFL caucus, and then this is posted online for public consumption. And I just want to bring it to your attention that I've never seen this, and going on 13 years in the legislature, if we're going to start posting our own caucuses, media and communications departments, publications, then we're going to be filling up the documents that are going to be viewable by the public. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I don't know if there's a rule against it. There may be, but it was stunning to me to see it posted online. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. I mean, I will note that in years past, the things that are posted with the committee posting of all the documents that have been submitted, in the past, those things would have been handed out in committee, and so they wouldn't have necessarily been uploaded onto the site. And so I've certainly seen things, partisan things going one way or the other throughout the years handed out in committee. And so I think, that's sort of the equivalent to keep in mind, but noted, Representative Scott, and I'm sure Ms. Ghanani is listening as well, as far as determining what's appropriate to post online with our committee meetings. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And even for handouts in committee, I know that I have never handed out a document that was produced by our communications department. Never. Handed that out to the committee. So, I know we've handed out various documents every time there's a hearing. I get that. And I get that we're posting it online now, but I've never seen anything like that even passed out in committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And I did just receive a message from Representative Greenman that she didn't realize that that had been posted as well. So we will duly noted. We will take care to make sure that the things that we're posting are appropriate to be posted with the committee posting. On to the next question, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenman, thank you for bringing this bill. Good to see you today. And, the one thing I want to say out front is that in this moment, I think it's more important than ever that we not only create provisions to protect our democracy and protect the sacred right to vote, but also to expand it. Specifically, I'm looking at the bill to restore the felony rights. I mean, I think you talked about it a bit. These are individuals, and I know I've represented some folks that are in situations like this. They're back in the community. They're paying taxes. They're working jobs. They're providing for their families. They're helping their neighbors, and they do not have the ability to exercise their right to vote. Their voice cannot be heard. And we have to make sure that we stop continuing to disenfranchise these individuals. We've seen what it's like to expand the voter access. We've seen what it's like when they have the ability to exercise their vote. You get elected officials that represent the community. That's what happens. And that's what this representative democracy is about. And I just like for you, so that's a statement, but I'd like for you to talk a bit about the protections that will be provided for election judges. I know we had a testifier that talked about how she had some concerns around that. She went back, she was brave, and she went back, but she had some concerns around the intimidation piece and the suppression pieces. Can you talk a bit about what this bill will provide for protections around that area?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. And I think I appreciate the question, and I appreciate the question both about rights restoration and about the protection of election judges. And I think just to sort of pick up on to Representative Scott's flag is that, you know, these are nonpartisan issues. They're not even bipartisan issues. They're about Minnesotans. And so when we think about what I have been hearing about the voter intimidation and the intimidation of election judges, we heard both from like Ms. Stossel, but also I heard it from county folks who are having a hard time recruiting election judges because after they saw the Atlas AGS question article, there was a concern about what protections are there to protect voters from intimidation, to protect election judges from intimidation. I know we have somebody from the Attorney General's office who may be on the line who can sort of speak to the need for it. I will say right now our laws are not good enough to provide the Attorney General and law enforcement what they need to protect voters in all of the ways that we've seen the rising of intimidation and attempted interference in the vote. So if Attorney General Ellison or his deputy is on and they want to speak a little bit to the voter intimidation provision.
Sure.
And go ahead, introduce yourself for the committee and just stick to the matters at hand, please.
Sure. This is James Canadam, Deputy Attorney General. Attorney General Keith Ellison was on earlier in the meeting, and I'm expecting he would have interrupted me if he were still here. So I believe he had to drop off. Just to briefly answer the question raised, Representative Greenman, about the need for specific enforcement authority. Article 3, Section 3 of the bill, Section 2 of the bill, provides specific authority under Section 8.31, which is the Attorney General's enforcement powers, to enforce the intimidation and deceptive practices prohibitions that are added in this bill. And so just to make an analogy to the work that I do every day, Section 8.31 is the section of the statutes where the Attorney General gets the power to investigate consumer fraud, deceptive practices, unlawful advertising, all of those core consumer protection laws that we have in Minnesota that are enforced by the Attorney General. So this simply places all of the voter-specific prohibitions in that same section, meaning it gives us the same power to investigate and to enforce. So we can seek depositions without filing a lawsuit. We can send interrogatories or request documents without filing a lawsuit. And it would allow us to act quickly to address any concerns. So I'm happy to expand if anybody has additional questions, but that's the general answer. Thank you.
Nope, that was really helpful. Thank you, Mr. Canaday. Next, Representative Long.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Representative Greenman for her leadership in putting together this bill, which is long overdue and much needed and contains some provisions that we've been hearing from local governments for a long time that they need, from voters that they need. And I'm just very excited to get to hear this bill today. The question I have in particular is around Section 36 related to notice to voters who are having their rights restored. I have personally spoken with many voters who are eligible to vote, but who choose not to vote because they don't understand the rules around having their rights restored. And so these are folks who have completed the terms of their probation and have their rights restored, but they don't understand that means that they're now eligible to vote. They're afraid that, you know, they know that in the past they haven't been eligible, and so they're afraid to vote in those circumstances. And so you mentioned, Representative Greenman, that there are 50,000 folks whose rights aren't restored to them right now, but there are many more who choose not to vote because they don't understand when their rights are restored. And so I'm curious if you or your testifiers could speak to the importance of this provision.
Yep. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Representative Long. And I should have started by saying, I think a lot of these provisions have been worked on by many folks on this committee. And so to say that they're both overdue and also really sort of reflect the deep work that I think Minnesotans have done with many legislators. So I appreciate the question. And I think that this is an important one. So this one is one that I come by with personal experience. When I was a private attorney, I did a lot of pro bono expungements, and I had a client it was 2012, and she'd been off paper since 1996. She just never had anyone to ask. And so in 2012, she asked me if she could vote. And it had been, you know, what is that, 4, 5, 6 elections that she had the right to vote and just didn't know. And so I think that these provisions about both making sure that there's standard language so that everybody is hearing the same thing, making sure that there's sort of folks delegated to make sure that people get that notification is really important for the local folks who are going to be implementing this, and also for the voters the potential voters. And then the last thing I will say is I think that this provision is also really important for the administration of our elections. You hear from election judges, I hear from counties and cities and townships, but that the, you know, figuring out who's on and off papers is actually really complicated. And lots of folks are on for, my client had been on for years and years. And so this is also going to make our elections easier and more efficient to run, as well as being the right thing to do to ensure that folks living in our community have the right to vote and that they know their rights when they are restored. So appreciate the question.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Any follow-up, Representative Long? Next on the list is Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Greenman, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a bill that I could never support. There's so many things in here, I don't know where to start, but we got to start with the judiciary part of it. That's what we're, the only thing that we can talk about, that there's some issues in here that I have a great concern about. One of the first one is in Section 3, I believe it's in the, it was talked about a little earlier. I have a lot of problems giving the Attorney General not only investigation, but enforcement and powers doing the same thing, where the investigator is the enforcer, as far as in the court system, especially on felonies. This is with a two-year felony, a two-year prison term, that is a felony in Minnesota. And I don't know if the county attorneys have even been talked about this, is they are each, the county attorneys are the ones responsible for felonies in each county. They are the chief enforcement. Yes, there are some issues dealing with allowing the Attorney General to do something, to take control over some issues last year. But there was a lot of internal strife in the County Attorneys Association on that vote, and eventually it did not pass. And I know the Attorney General is trying to rebuild their criminal division, but
But where they belong really is in the civil law, protecting the civil rights of the consumers, not the criminal rights. So I have a lot of issues with that one. That's just one of many issues. I also, we talked about the restoration of rights. I've talked to many people on paper. They know the minute that they're off paper, they have their rights returned. And many of them, including their Second Amendment rights. So like I say, I got a lot of issues with this bill. I know it's going to public safety, but I'm still trying to figure out what public safety provisions will be able to talk about.
I believe the criminal enforcement provision that you just referenced would be something that's relevant to the Public Safety Committee response.
The Attorney General's office is under
Representative Johnson. Representative Greenman has the floor to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. This bill doesn't change the criminal authority of the Attorney General. It only gives the Attorney General civil enforcement authority. The criminal provisions remain, as you said, with the county attorneys.
Representative Johnson.
I was going to say the Attorney General is under this jurisdiction, the judiciary, I believe. Not the public safety, but that's, like I say, that's one of the issues I have. There's just many things in this bill that I have issues with. I'll leave it at that. Just
all right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just really wanted to thank Representative Greenman for her leadership and for bringing this forward. My grandparents grew up in the Jim Crow South, and there is a lot of experience with voter intimidation, with the subtleties of suppressing votes. And we know now that that's spreading faster than ever across the entire country. And so I think this is really great because it takes proactive steps to protect our democracy and protect the rights of people to participate in that democracy. So I really don't have a question, just commendment on this important work. So thank you very much.
Right. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Not seeing any other hands raised, and there were no other amendments filed. So given that, I will renew my motion that House File 9, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy Committee. Ms. Borgerding, please take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Sean.
Aye.
Perfect. There are 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right. With 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 9, as amended, is on its way to the Public Safety Committee. With that, members, we've got 12 minutes, and we've got one more bill on the agenda. It is House File 348, Representative Scott's bill. Representative Scott, would you like to move your... Oh, I guess we're moving for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, but Representative Scott, would you like to move your bill?
Sure, Madam Chair. I would move House File... What is it again? 348?
Yep.
to be recommended for inclusion in a possible omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. With that, your bill is before us. I believe you have an author's amendment, the A21. 0008, author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. This amendment puts the bill in the version that we'd like, and it's the same as what we did in 2019. And I would move the A19 amendment.
And actually, I'm going to ask staff real quick just to make sure we've got the right amendment number. Is it the A19?
I'm sorry,
correct?
No, that's not right.
The A21-0008.
Okay. And as Representative Scott knows, you got to make sure you've got everything accurate in a minute. So Representative Scott moves the A21-0008 amendment. Not seeing any hands up. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
All right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Scott, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll try to keep my comments brief so we can get to the testifiers. But I think we all have experienced, we probably know somebody or work with somebody that has experienced a divorce, going through a divorce, or in the case of never married parents, just separating, and the harm that, you know, the difficulty that that is, not only for the adults, the parents, but for the children too. We know the outcomes for the children are sometimes not good when they go through this separation of their parents, and it's increased rates of anxiety and depression. School productivity, behaviors, all those sorts of things. And then we also know that parents can also be really negatively affected with feelings of depression and loneliness, regret, and really all-out helplessness in some cases. So in the Supreme Court or the legislature back in 1996-97 noted that those are problems. And so they asked the Supreme Court to look into what we can do to help address those issues. And one of the recommendations of the Supreme Court Task Force on Visitation and Child Support Enforcement came up with this order for not only, well, there's a whole list of things, but one of those things is for parent education. And so on the posting documents that we set up for this committee, there is a document entitled Court Order on Parent Education. And if you go to Appendix A of that, it states the purpose for these parent education classes. And it's basically the purpose of a parent education program should be to serve as an early intervention mechanism to encourage cooperation between parents before adversarial behavior and conflict have a chance to develop. And it goes on to explain other goals. And so the reason that I'm bringing this bill forward is that courts are not implementing current law consistently from one jurisdiction to the next. And currently some parents, although required by state statute to have the parenting classes in contested cases, are not taking the classes because judges aren't ordering them to do so. And there seems to be some difference in the way the word contested is interpreted. I'm not sure how that happens, but so what this bill language does is it would require classes to be court ordered in cases where the parents haven't agreed to custody or parenting time schedule. And to keep up with technology, we're requiring that the chief judge of each judicial district post information about these classes on the district's website. And I think that may have already been done. And also, I just want to make it clear that there is a cost to these parent education classes. It's between $70 and $90. Dollars, but state statute allows anybody that qualifies for a waiver of court filing fees that they will receive these parent education classes for free. So I will now turn it over to the testifiers, and they can tell you a little bit more about the bill and the reason behind it. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Right. First on the list, I have Diane Anderson, and I'll just remind the testifiers that we've got just a couple minutes, so you know, try to be as focused as you can be. Ms. Anderson, please introduce yourself for the committee and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Diane Anderson, and I'm a former state representative, and I thank Representative Scott for bringing this bill forward so we can make some much needed changes to an existing law that we have. And there's just a lot of great research out there that's been done regarding the effectiveness of divorce education programs. Parents who attended the parent education classes generally avoid exposing their children to conflict situations and are more aware of their children's feelings than a comparison group of parents. And parents who attended the divorce education classes have lower relitigation rates than those who did not attend. And Parents Forever has done some great studies. They hand out a survey after their classes, and they just have a wide variety of things that they ask people. And the majority of the people state that they really benefited in a lot of ways for taking these classes. So there's some really great parent education classes out there that have been developed. Our next testifier is going to talk to you about the Parents Forever class. And many people are just not attending these classes. Many parents don't know that there are these parent education classes are available and that there's a lot of benefits in the information that they learn from these classes. And having information about the classes on the court website will be a big help to get the information out to people. And one of the biggest things is the classes are best if they're taken at the beginning of the court process. One of the biggest complaints that people have said is they wish they had taken the classes sooner. So, and there's also a growing number of pro se people. Those are people who don't have attorneys. And so these parent education classes would be really valuable to pro se people because it's going to give them a lot of information that they wouldn't otherwise be getting. And just to note on line 2.14 of the bill, people do have the option to opt out of having to take the classes if, you know, they really can't. Their summary, it's not going to be hard to opt out. So Representative Scott said, and the legislature requested on November 11th, 1995, the Minnesota Supreme Court issued an order establishing the Advisory Task Force on Visitation Child Support Enforcement. And I was actually a member on this task force. And the task force conducted research, a lot of research, and they made recommendations. And in that report, if anybody wants to have a copy, it's a very lengthy report, recommendations number 1 and 2, which of the task force report, which is dated January 27th, 1997, the task force made recommendations to implement a statewide parent education program, which is what we have in our law right today under Minnesota Statute 518.157, and it was passed back in 1997. So the task force conducted a survey of parents and judicial officers, and both were strongly supportive of a policy which would require parents to attend parent education classes before being permitted to proceed with their divorce or paternity actions. And on page 43 of this report, the researchers reported the data show that once having completed a program, parents find them to be relevant, realistic, and useful. And so I really believe that House File 347 makes some much needed changes to the existing parent education statute, and I would appreciate your support for this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Anderson. We've got one question, but I want to get to the second testifier, Dr. Beecher. If you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. And I will note, members, that there was also information included in your virtual packets from the U of M.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, representatives. My name is Emily Bescher. I'm an applied research and evaluation specialist at the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Family Development. My testimony today is to share the value of parent education during divorce, separation, and changes in custody. Interparental conflict, separation, and divorce are identified as adverse childhood experiences, often referred to as ACEs. As children are exposed to more ACEs, risk increases overall for a variety of poor outcomes, including declining health and well-being later in life. Research on divorcing families has identified that the unique risk factor for children in these circumstances is continued pervasive conflict between co-parents before, during, and after relationship dissolution. While divorce rates in the U.S. continue to decline, 23% of children live in a household with a single parent, which is 3 times the amount compared to the rest of the world. It is critical for the welfare of children of these families that as parents form and sometimes dissolve their relationships, they work towards healthy co-parenting and reduce conflict. The University of Minnesota Extension developed the Parents Forever curriculum in the mid-1990s in response to requests for education for parents in the divorce and separation process. Research indicates that divorce and co-parenting education have positive impacts on families, and our evaluation data indicates that Parents Forever is an effective program in promoting positive co-parenting and positive parenting practices. In 2020, 1,530 participants registered for the Parents Forever program. Of those participants, 973 completed a post survey. Of those, 96% said they had never taken a course like this previously, and 88% said that they were required by the court to take the class. After taking the class, 81% said that they were glad to have participated in the course, regardless of whether they had been required to participate. The majority of survey participants indicated they had positive experiences. So, for example, 90% of participants agreed that the course would be beneficial for other divorcing parents, and 81% agreed that the course helped them to think of new ways to resolve conflict about their children with the children they have with their co-parent. 79% agreed the course helped them to assist their children in the coping process, and 83% agreed the course helped them to be more attentive to their children's needs in the divorce process. Participants share many comments about their experience. Just a couple examples. One parent shared, "I strongly feel that parents should be required to take this course early as a first step in the transition, to have the tools and knowledge to better handle and approach already existing problems or issues they may be experiencing with a co-parent and children." Or as another participant shared, "Thanks for the instillation of hope that this journey is about love for our children." Please let me know if you have additional questions, and thank you.
Thank you. Not seeing any other member questions. Representative Scott, any closing comments?
No, I just thank you, Madam Chair, for giving the bill a hearing, and thank you to our testifiers. I think this is a small thing that we can do to really help kids and parents better cope with dissolving families.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Scott would renews her motion. Oh, I guess we're her motion that we're laying over House File 348 as amended. And so the bill is laid over. And with that, members, it is 10 o'clock. Thank you, everyone, for staying focused today. I do appreciate it. We should be sending out the agenda for next week very soon. Representative Robbins, real quick.
I'm so sorry, Madam Chair. I didn't get to vote. Is it too late? I'm sorry. I was here, but I was on a phone call, so I couldn't organize my technology.
No, Representative Robbins, the bill's just being laid over, so there wasn't.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Sorry. So sorry to interrupt, Madam Chair.
Yep, it's okay. we're all multitasking and trying to do a lot right now, so it's okay. So, and as I was mentioning, the agenda for next week should be emailed out shortly. And thank you, members, for a productive week. And with that, we are adjourned.